Today is the second day of this September, October, 7 days, Sesshin at Chapin Mill. And it's the 1st of October. Yesterday I gave the wrong date. It was the 30th, not the 29th. You can put it down to a bit of lingering jet lag confusion. We're going to continue reading from the same text as we were looking at yesterday, Attaining the Way, A Guide to the Practice of Chan Buddhism, by Chan Master Shen Yin and others. And we left off, we're looking at the three essential ingredients of Zen practice: great faith, great doubt, and great determination. And really, whatever practice we're doing, all three are necessary, but the emphasis varies from practice to practice, which one is to the fore. And since we're reading from teachers who put an emphasis on koan or the huado, they tend to also put an emphasis on this the importance of great doubt. We may not be conscious of having some kind of focused question, some strong doubt in this sense. But there does need to be, even when there isn't that conscious existential question, there still needs to be recognition of the first noble truth of suffering, and recognizing it on a personal level, that recognizing our own dis-ease, and also for there to be not just this recognition, but also a desire to find a way to address it. And naturally, it has to be some faith that it's possible to do that. And we wouldn't be here if we didn't have that faith. Continuing with the preface. Shakyamuni's fundamental question before he became a Buddha was how to end human suffering, and that question was suddenly and completely resolved after 6 years of austere practice when he saw the morning star following 6 days and nights of meditating under the Bodhi tree. Let's just look at, for a moment, at this question of the Buddhas. How to end human suffering. Actually, it was even bigger than that. It was how to address the suffering of all beings. Of course, he was included in that, but it was much broader than his own difficulties. The thing about a great vow like this is that it is a very powerful propeller for the practice. If we have a vow that includes others, that's bigger than us, then we won't be put off by the setbacks that we may experience, or the obstacles that come up, because the whole process is not just about us. So it is really important to develop bodhicitta. This bodhicitta, literally it means the heart mind of enlightenment. But it's understood within the Mahayana tradition to mean a bit more than that. It's the heart that aspires to awaken in order to be able to liberate all beings. So the great vow is incorporated in this. We chant, all beings without number I vow to liberate. When people first encounter this this vow, sometimes balk because it seems so vast and really impossible. We may think, I can barely deal with my own problems. How could I possibly liberate all sentient beings? And it's true that when we're stressed or overwhelmed, then we don't have the resources to be concerning ourselves with others. Well, that, at least that's how it feels. And certainly. We may not be able to feel any love or compassion for people in our lives who are bothering us. We may think to be totally obnoxious. I think here of a bumper sticker that Roshi had on his car a few years ago. Mean people are suffering. If we can remember this, especially when we're in a situation of conflict, then we can actually reduce our stress. Because when we can generate some compassion for another person, immediately we lift ourselves out of the narrow place of our self-concern, and we enter into a wider world. This is one of the ways that we can understand this vow that we take, all beings without number I vow to liberate. Another problem people sometimes have with this vow is, how can I possibly liberate all beings? And how can I even begin to imagine what all beings are, who they are? Somebody once asked a teacher what it means that this all beings, and he said it means everybody you encounter. That brings it down to a more manageable level. If we just think in terms of anybody that we encounter in our lives, we have a karmic connection with them. That's why we meet them, because there's a connection, and therefore it's an opportunity to direct compassion towards that person or other being. All the beings we encounter. A cockroach, an ant, a fly. Somebody at work that we don't get on with, who just rubs us up the wrong way. To actually understand that every encounter is momentous. Of all the trillions of beings in the universe, we're encountering this being. How extraordinary. Back to the preface. Huado and Gong'an are merely devices. As methods, they are problems created by Chan masters for practitioners to use in meditation. Traditionally, some Chan practitioners used a single Huado all their lives, even after breaking through the doubt and realizing enlightenment. Virtually no one in this day and age can realize thorough enlightenment all at once. For this reason, the same Huado can be used over and over again to generate the doubt sensation, which is then shattered repeatedly until all vexation, self-attachment, and unwholesome habits are relinquished in the full manifestation of wisdom and genuine compassion. This is actually quite common in Korea, that people will take up a koan and work on it for their whole life. There, commonly, it is, what is this? And this question can never be exhausted. How extraordinary that is. We can never get to the bottom of it. The writer here says, the same Huado can be used over and over again to generate the doubt sensation, which is then shattered repeatedly until all vexations, self-attachment, and unwholesome habits are relinquished in the full manifestation of wisdom and genuine compassion. That's possible. It's something we can put our faith in. But it's fair to say that it's rare. And none of us knows how long it's going to take us. It's with vows. We've got to make them in a kind of open-ended way, without conditions. I vow to relinquish all self-attachment, all unwholesome habits, however long it takes. However many lifetimes. In the Vajrayana tradition, there is a slogan, abandon all hope of fruition. Fruition is another way of saying full enlightenment. Aspire to enlightenment, but we don't attach to a result at a certain time in a certain way. It's just stuff in the mind. It's just self-attachment, really. it's self-attachment that is our true enemy, really. Thinking that we are more important than other people. One of the ways that this comes about or is active in our lives is we can be very forgiving of our own shortcomings and very hard on others about theirs. We can sometimes catch ourselves in this. Maybe people with spouses and partners may have had this experience where there's something they do, your partner does, which you find annoying, and you find yourself one day mentally scolding your partner for having done it again, and then suddenly you realise, oh, it was you. Say it's leaving the car windows open so that rain comes in, and you're going, Richard did it again, he left the car windows open. And then you realise, oh no, I was the last one to drive the car. It was me. Oh, well, that's not so bad. What if we could really cherish everyone without any discrimination? What kind of world would that be for everyone? We'll go on now to the first of the master's teachings in this book, Master Baoshan, and just a little bit of biographical material on him. His full Dharma name was Wu Yi Yuan Lai, and his dates are 1575 to around 1630, so he's was teaching much later than the most of the masters we usually encounter in our texts, the Ming Dynasty, and the translator here says, Wu Yi Yuan Lai was one of the most revered masters in the Cao Dong lineage. During the Ming Dynasty, and Cao Dong is the Chinese pronunciation of Soto. He left the household life at age 16 after hearing lectures on the Lotus Sutra. After becoming a monk, he practiced in the Tien Tai method of stillness and contemplation, that's Shamatha Vipassana, which is related to Shikantaza. And it was silent illumination. He practiced this method for 5 years before starting to study under an eminent Chan master, Wu Ming Hui Xing. Through the practice of Gong'an and Hua Do, Yuan Lai had numerous insights, which by today's laxer standards would be considered experiences of enlightenment. However, Hui Xing did not affirm any of Yuan Lai's realizations. Again and again, Hui Xing scolded Yuan Lai and turned him away, thus generating more doubt in him. One day, while watching someone climbing a tree, Yuan Lai's doubt was completely shattered. He experienced thorough enlightenment, and life and death no longer had a hold on him. It was only then that Master Hui Xing affirmed Yuan Lai's understanding. At the time, Yuan Lai was only 27. Later, Yuan Lai studied the precepts under Master Yun Qi Zhu Hong and travelled broadly. He finally settled down on Mount Boshan to teach for the rest of his life. In the Chan custom of referring to eminent masters by their place of settlement, he then became known as Master Boshan. Although Boshan belonged to the Caodong school, he freely used the Gong'an and Huado methods, which are usually associated nowadays with the Linji, that's the Rinzai school. However, in Chinese Chan, the methods of practice were always flexible. Not surprisingly, since the methods are only expedient means, devices used to awaken the student's wisdom. But there are other social and historical reasons behind Boshan's style of teaching. He goes into describing how this late Ming Dynasty period was a time when the collections of koans were being quite widely circulated. This is due to the use of printed books that meant that they were dispersed into all levels of society. And so this accessibility, he says, also caused the Chan teachings to be secularized and misunderstood. And so part of the project, Boshan, was to correct mistakes that had risen up because of this secularization or sort of dumbing down of the texts and of insight, real insight. So we'll turn now to the text, which starts off the title, What Beginning Chan Practitioners Should Know. At the very outset of practice, arouse the aspiration to break through the mind of birth and death. The mind of birth and death is the mind, the dualistic mind, the mind that gets caught up in opposites. Birth and death, of course, thinking, imagining that these are two separate things. Good and bad, gain and loss, success and failure is a big one that gets us. Praise and blame. And along with the way in which we get caught up in these sets of apparent opposites, is that we engage our mind of picking and choosing, as it says in Affirming Faith and Mind. We desperately try to keep at bay the unpleasant side of these dualisms and to acquire or to hold on to the pleasant side. So we attach to good and to gain and to success and praise, and we reject their opposites. And then when we come into practice, we keep doing this, but now it can be around for instance, concentration and distraction. We think concentration is good and distraction is bad, and we attach to concentration and reject distraction. Or the things we think are distracting us. We can also create another set of opposites out of sesshin and ordinary life. We can get attached to the quiet and stillness of sesshin, and then have a hard time afterwards letting go of that and going back to all the demands of our ordinary lives. So something, it's deep conditioning in us to do this with our experience. At the very outset of practice, arouse the aspiration to break through the mind of birth and death, to break through this deeply ingrained habit of clinging to the pleasant and rejecting the unpleasant. With determined resolve, see through the universe, body and mind, and realize that everything is the coming together of provisional conditions without a substantial self. And all conditions that come together disperse. This is the fact of our existence. Nothing is substantial. Not even the self that we so cherish. If you cannot discover the original great principle that is within you, the mind of birth and death will never be shattered. The original great principle is another way of pointing to a Buddha nature. Our true nature, our true self that is no self. So to truly free ourselves from the mind of birth and death requires our seeing into this original great principle. Even to just get a glimpse makes a difference. Can strengthen our faith and our resolve to continually work on ourselves. When the mind of birth and death is not shattered, the slaying ghost of impermanence will continue without end in your each and every thought, haunting you. This is actually where the damage is done, in our thoughts. We're burdened by anxieties around death. This is the slaying ghost of impermanence. It may be physical death, and often people say they're more afraid of becoming incapacitated in the whole process of dying than they are of actual death. but it's also often just the death of the self in the sense of who and what we cling to as our identity. This can be sometimes stronger than the fear of physical death. You should be like someone sitting in the midst of a raging fire, wanting to escape. Do not step haphazardly. Do not stand still. Give rise to no other thoughts, and don't count on the help of others. At this point, throw away your concerns about the raging fire, your very life, your anticipation of others' help. With no other thoughts and refusing to halt, just directly go forward. If you can break out of the raging fire, then you're a person of great abilities. Actually, each of us are already a raging fire. This isn't just a metaphor. We're burning up. We're like a candle, lit candle. Our life is the death of us. To be born is to die. To be consumed. In the course of practice, the most crucial thing is to arouse the doubt sensation. What is this doubt? Not knowing where you came from prior to your birth, you have no choice but to wonder where you are from. Oblivious to where you will go after you die, how can you not question where you will end up? Your inability to shatter this barrier of birth and death will suddenly arouse the doubt, like a curled knot on our eyelashes, which you are unable to untangle or get rid of. One day you will suddenly shatter this mass of doubt and realize that the term birth and death is useless garbage. And he repeats this Zen saying, the ancient worthies said, great doubt, great enlightenment. Small doubt, small enlightenment. No doubt, no enlightenment. Of course, in the course of practice, the most fearful thing is to settle into a state of stagnation and to attach to quiescence, becoming dry and lifeless, unknowing and ignorant, and detesting activity while taking pleasure in quietude. Since practitioners have always lived amid noisy, busy situations, experiencing quiescence is like eating candy and honey. We can experience the big contrast going from all the busyness of getting ready for Sesshin, coming in, and then the quiet, the spaciousness. I can really appreciate and go, but it'll pass. Before we know it, Sesshin will be over, we'll be dispersing, and those ideal conditions will be gone. So to attach to them is a mistake, a big mistake. He says attaching to quiescence is like an exhausted person enjoying a long sleep. And we didn't come to Sesshin to sleep. How will they know that they're already stagnating in quiescence? Because if you're asleep, there's nothing you can do about it. So you wake up. In the midst of stillness, we must discover this precious thing hidden under the lining of the garment. This refers to a story that appears in the Lotus Sutra. And it's a story told by the Buddha about a traveler who became drunk, and a friend of his, wanting to help him, sewed a precious jewel into the lining of his friend's robe when he slept, and then he left. So when the drunken man awoke, he continued on his journey, and he had all kinds of difficulties and hardships and no money, but he didn't know that there was this jewel sewed into his robe. So when the two friends met again later, and the formerly drunk man told of all the troubles he'd be having, then his friend told him about the jewel that he could have used to relieve his suffering, that was there all along, but he didn't know about it. And this is just an image of a true nature, that it's there all along. We have it. It's right intimately with us. And yet, as long as we don't know it, then we can't make use of it. It's not something active in our lives. We have to turn towards it. We have to discover it. So this is what Master Bhoshan is referring to when he says, in the midst of stillness, we must discover this precious thing hidden in the lining of the garment. Must reveal this treasure. You can only resolve the great matter of birth and death in the midst of stillness while not knowing that you are in stillness. If you seek to resolve this great matter in stillness, then you'll never attain it. If you don't seek, then you are sure to get it. If we're seeking stillness, then that's actually a disturbance in the mind. And it's a kind of ego project, and so it's not going to fully resolve our suffering, since it's the ego that's the problem. This was what he means when he says, if you don't seek, then you are sure to get it. It's revealed when we relinquish our ego maneuvering, when we give everything up. In our absorption in the question, in the course of practice, do not fear that in death you will not live. Instead, fear living without having experienced the great death. If you can fasten yourself to the doubt, there will be no need to leave behind motion and stillness. They will depart by themselves. We'll forget about such concepts. Nor will there be a need to purify the deluded mind. The deluded mind will be purified by itself. At that time, the gates of the six roots will naturally be expansively open, like empty space. Touch it, and you will arrive. Call it, and it will respond. Why worry about not living? He refers here to the gates of the six roots. The six roots are six senses. Our eyes, our ears, our nose, our tongue, our body, and our discriminating intellect. And he says when we purify our deluded mind, then the gates of the six roots will be naturally, expansively open. In Sesshin, we try to create the best possible conditions for the practice, and that involves quieting everything down, keeping everything orderly, so that we experience fewer distractions. But we discover that even with this effort to create good conditions, there'll always be something that we can latch onto as a distraction, however much we tweak our environment. Whether it's the person next to us who's breathing in an annoying way, or the temperature in the zendo, or strong odors, the way our bedroom is arranged, all of these things we can think that they are the problem, and we can then try to adjust things, change things, so that we're feeling more comfortable one way or another. But changing conditions around us never gets to the root of the problem. At a certain point, we have to start looking at our reactions to these assaults on our senses. It's not the senses themselves that are a problem. This is what Bhoshan is pointing to when he says that when we purify the mind, the gates of the six roots will naturally be expansively open like empty space. No obstructions there, no rejection, no clinging. It's wide open. It's our reactions to our sense impressions that are the problem, not the sense impressions themselves. But we live in a culture which is highly focused on massaging conditions so that they're just right, just how we want them to be. And this is held up as being something worth doing. Somebody told me a story last week at a tea break about people at Microsoft. They have apparently a wonderful cafe there, which includes a wood-fired pizza oven. And so the people, the employees there are often take their pizzas to their desks, because of course they're eating and working simultaneously and probably doing 80-hour weeks eating on the job. And some of the engineers there were concerned that the pizzas, when they were taken from the cafe to the people's desks, they would get soggy. And so they designed a new pizza box that would solve the problem of soggy pizzas. So all this human energy and effort went into producing a better pizza box, a new and improved pizza box. But, of course, the big question would be, were those employees at Microsoft any happier because their pizzas stayed crunchy a little bit longer? No doubt some other thorn in the mud would arise to vex the Microsoft employees. When bringing forth the hua do, be alert and clear, like a cat catching a mouse. This is also a really good image for Shikantaza as well. The energy of a cat sitting, watching a mouse hole, alert, but flexible, relaxed, open. We can learn a lot from cats in this regard. But here's what Boshan says. When bringing forth the hua do, be alert and clear, like a cat catching a mouse. There's an old saying, don't rest until the cunning ferret is killed. And there's a footnote about this reference to a ferret. A ferret is an analogy of the self, which is clever and always on the move. Even though tamed, it can still be aggressive and harm its surroundings. Ferrets are attachment to self, you could say. Or else, don't. So, there's an old saying, don't rest until the cunning ferret is killed, or else you will sit there, dwelling in the cave of ghosts, spending your life in dullness and confusion. What will be the use of that? When a cat is trying to catch a mouse, its eyes are wide open and its four limbs are firmly on the ground. It will not rest until the mouse is in its mouth. Even if there are roosters or dogs at its side, the cat will not be distracted. It should be the same for those who investigate Chan. Have the determination to actualize this principle. Have the determination to actualize this principle. If we have faith in the teachings, if we believe that we are endowed with this Buddha nature, this great principle, then we're called upon to make it real in our lives. No one can do this for us. No one can help. They can perhaps direct us in the right direction, but that's about it. Otherwise, it's up to us. Don't rest until the cunning ferret is killed. Don't rest until you've put down all your maneuvering, all your angling for small self. Only then will things open up. Then we become open, like empty space. We'll stop here and recite the four vows. All beings without number, I bow to the great endless flying passions. I bow to our brute Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number.
I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot Dharma days beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow